York. Our speakers over the week are going to be Hector E. from Los Angeles, California. Chris R. from San Antonio, Texas. Peter M. from Staten Island, New York. And Maya Zarr from Dallas, Texas.
Talk about being energized. God, if it's all the same to you guys, I got to stand up. There's only one thing I can do sitting down, and I can't do it here. So I mean, we're just for those I haven't met, my name is Myers Raymer, and I am an alcoholic. I took my last drink on January 15th, 88, and what a ride! What an absolute ride! Yes, I'm not Chris. Everybody keeps running up, going, "Oh, you're not Chris," and they just kind of I got to get one piece of house cleaning stuff done first, like that. Let me see if I understand this right. You have to pay 20 cents to sit in a taxi that's sitting still. Is that how that works? How do you stay sober here? I'd be drunk all the time just trying to figure this. This is the. It's so different here from Texas. I just, God, man, it is cool, but different. You know, if you've heard Chris talk before, you know that Chris had a real tough time getting here, and I had no trouble at all getting to AA. What I had trouble was staying here once I got here, because things in our neck of the woods, I don't know if they are that way here, but in our neck of the woods, things in AA have gotten really bizarre. And sometimes you don't really know where you are. You can sit in meetings for weeks and not know that AA exists there. I mean, we're talking about Sally Sue's problem, and we're talking about Joe's divorce again, and you know the drill. Anyway, we're not going to harbor on a bunch of that stuff. But the big question came up was, why don't more old timers stay in AA? You know, we went to Iceland earlier this year, and there was a sea, an absolute sea of young people in that room. And I was the oldest guy at 49 in that room. There may have been one other guy older than me in there. But the question, this reoccurring thing that keeps hitting me is, why is it that old guys don't stick around and people don't stay here? Statistically, one-third of the people, of all the people that come to AA, two-thirds of them will be gone in the first 90 days, which kind of shoots that 90 meetings and 90 days things right in the foot, right? I mean, it doesn't make much sense. And so what I'm hoping that we'll accomplish this weekend is have everybody start thinking again and asking questions about why we're here. Where am I? You know, we get spoon-fed AA when we come in, and that becomes our doctrine, and that becomes what we teach. And we assume it's the right thing. And generation after generation do that, you see. The guys that I sponsor, that's how they do it. And then the guys they sponsor, that's how they go. And that's how AA has gotten so bizarre. What I'm hoping we'll do this weekend, and it's my fervent prayer that that's what we'll do, is that we will get this thing kind of gathered up, and each one of us collectively will ask the hard questions. How is my program, mine, how am I doing sobriety-wise? And am I adhering to that fifth tradition or my primary purpose of carrying the message to another alcoholic? Where am I in the big picture of this stuff? When I grow up and have kids and they need AA, will AA still be here? I never thought I'd hear myself say that. I've got three beautiful daughters, and guess what? I got my eye on one of them already, and she's just a little bitty, you know what. But why is it that all of a sudden I'm worrying about whether or not AA will be here or not? Bill Wilson said years ago, AA will destroy itself from within, not from without, from the outside. And I truly believe that. And if you think I'm full of crap, well, I am. But besides, I am. But if you doubt that, go sit in some of our meetings and then compare it to what we're going to talk about this weekend, which is straight heads up big book stuff. Now I got to clarify something real quick. I'm not the brightest guy in the world. I'm not stupid, but I'm not the brightest guy in the world. And I know that, you guys, as a tradition, have had some very bright men up here doing this work. And you've had some very kind of esoteric AA pass through here, and some of it is wonderful. The guy that I sponsor is right off the street in Dallas, Texas, in Oak Cliff. Most of them are indigent. All of them are brutal alcoholics. A lot of them are drug addicts that we kind of get to other places. But I don't get too many college PhDs in my storehouse of guys that I work with. And so I tend to be very simple. The book was laid out real simple for Bill Wilson and those guys. Why do you think Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob kept talking the same thing over and over and over again? You ever notice how many times the themes in AA repeat themselves over and over? This theme of willingness, this reoccurring theme of action that we're going to take. You see, Bill knew, man, we got heads that are mush when we get here. We don't need 38-page inventories right off the bat. Later on, if you want to do that, we'll get into that some tomorrow. We'll do that. If you want to get, anyway, every time I do this kind of work, what I try to do is I try to filter this stuff and do it as I would work with it. If this man came up to me tonight and said, Myers, I want you to carry me through this work. I try to go as straightforward out of the book as I possibly can. I had all kinds. When I got here in 88, the men in that group loved me to death, and they blew so much psycho stuff up my rear end, it was not even funny. I could tell you about inner children. I could tell you about feelings. I could tell you about everything except how to live a sober life peacefully in my own skin. I could not tell you how to do that. And so imagine my surprise at 7 years sober when I'm unraveling. I'm writing hot checks all over Denton County. I cannot stand to be in my own skin. I'm going to 5 meetings a week. I'm doing everything I think I'm supposed to do, and I simply cannot stand it. Chris said one time that statistically the largest bunch of people committing suicide in the United States today are people in 12-step recovery groups. How sad is that? There was a guy in Houston did a bunch of stuff a long time ago. This has been 5 or 6 years ago, and his whole process was talking about, what he was talking about was that most of us that come to AA get hung up in the fellowship end of the deal, and we never get off into the nuts and bolts of AA. Why we're here, the steps and God and a psychic change guaranteed to send us to another place. We never get there because we're too busy slapping each other on the bottom and telling off-color jokes and 13-stepping that poor little girl that came in shaking, and you get the drill. And it pains me no end. And the older I get and the longer I'm in this fellowship, it causes me more concern. And so it's our hope tonight that we're gonna stay plugged into this deal and try to kind of get us through this work a little bit and hopefully enlighten you on some stuff. And as we do this, if you would please, for me, continually ask yourself the question, how am I doing on this stuff? Am I okay? You see, the length of time you're sober has nothing to do with your sobriety. And it has nothing to do with the health of your sobriety. I know guys that are 20 years sober that are so sick it's not even funny. The spiritual malady is still kicking them all over the place. They can't stand themselves, nor can the people around them stand them. You see? The length of time from your last drink has got nothing to do with it. I got kids that I sponsor that have been sober for 6 months, and I guarantee you, these little guys are like AA, just, they're machines. They're just out there carrying messages and I'm not kidding you. And it's just the coolest thing to see. And if my daughter reached out her hand tonight and said, I want help, I guarantee you one of those little buckaroos would be who I'd hook her up with, because they're flat ass on fire and they love God and they love our program, and that's the kind of guy I want hooked up to my daughter. You see? We're gonna talk here about the doctor's opinion in just a minute, but we want to do some stuff on the preface and Bill's story. I mean, the preface and the foreword to the first edition. One of the things that we want to do is, in the very first of this thing, in the preface, there's a line in there, there's a paragraph in there. This is not going to work for crap going through this book without a podium to set this on. If somebody's got a podium someplace, I'd give them a $5 bill just to have something to set my poor book on. In the preface in the front of this book, it says, because this book has become the basic text for our society and has helped such large numbers of alcoholic men and women to recovery, This is the first place in the book, or the second place in the book, actually, where they start talking about recovery, and they start getting this set up for this thing as being a way of life. These guys that talk about being, this is so cool. Ask and you shall receive. This is so cool. These guys. Oh, shit. It must be his attitude, you know. It doesn't work like that. You can tell who God loves best. You know, this stuff of guys being in the fellowship in this program for 10 or 15 years and still introducing themselves, hi, my name is Joe and I'm a recovering alcoholic. If you'll start back at the beginning of this book and count through the first 20 pages of how many times recovered is mentioned, it'll blow you away. Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob and those first 100 guys that got and gals that got together and wrote this thing believed beyond a shadow of a doubt that we could recover completely and fully from the disease of alcoholism and we could be done with this stuff forever. This crap of being constantly in recovery just drives me nuts. Look at the flip back over to the forward to the first edition. I love this stuff. This first paragraph tells us everything we need to know about why we need to have our beak in this book. We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered, there it is again, that's three times, from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Too cool. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. Now look, there is no ambivalence here. There's no room for oh, it just drives me nuts when I hear this stuff. These guys sitting in meetings and they wondering what Bill Wilson really meant when he said this and whether we really can do this and whether we can really expect this. There it is, right there. They were talking about full recovery from Alcoholics Anonymous, from the disease of alcoholism. I'm not sure it's going to flow over this one. Let's see. Too cool. Thank you. Can y'all hear me okay? I can't tell you how much better that is. So you guys understand this stuff. They're talking about precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. They were going to tell us exactly what the deal was, and we understand that. Flip over to the forward of the second edition because I want to get into the doctor's opinion as quick as we can. One of the greatest sources of AA history that there is in this book is in the forward of the second edition. We get to talk about the traditions and how we came up with this kind of stuff. Look at the bottom of XVI, Roman numeral 16. This physician had repeatedly tried spiritual means to resolve his chronic dilemma, but had failed. They're talking about Bill. But when the broker gave him Dr. Silkworth's description, they were talking about Dr. Bob. When the broker gave Dr. Silkworth's description of alcoholism and its hopelessness, the physician began to pursue the spiritual remedy for his malady with a willingness he had never been able to muster. It wasn't about a meeting. It wasn't about anything else except this understanding. Bill Wilson gave Dr. Bob a roaring case of alcoholism. He was the first guy to explain to Dr. Bob what this whole deal was about. Chris will talk about this some a little bit later on this evening. At the top of that page, it also indicated that strenuous work, one alcoholic with another, was vital to permanent recovery. There it is. That's four times there. It also indicated that strenuous work, one alcoholic with another, was vital to permanent recovery. It didn't say one thing about going to meetings. There's your 90 meetings in 90 days. Things out the window again. It didn't say that. It didn't say anything else other than we're going to work with somebody else. And if you don't get anything else out of this weekend, guys, if you're scared of 12-step work, you won't be come Sunday. You'll understand that your very recovery depends on your ability to carry a message of recovery to that guy or that girl that's reaching out to you. It is that and that only. And the next time somebody sits in your meeting and he's hurting like a big dog, don't you dare sit forward in your chair and say, you know, you just need to go to another meeting. No, you don't. You need to get off your lazy, self-centered rear and go find you a drunk to work with, and you're going to recover. And that's how that works, you see? It's cool. It works great. I want to take one side road here. I want to take one side road and talk just for a second about this tradition stuff that came in here. I want to put a couple of things Bill will correct me if I get off pace, so I feel like I'm in great shape here. If AA was formed, if the Big Book was written in 1939, picture this situation. They print all these Big Books, 5,000 Big Books in 1939, and they can't sell the suckers. They got a warehouse full of Big Books they can't sell. Fosdick comes in there and approves the whole thing. He says it's a cool book, and that starts getting some guys talking. Shortly after that, Fulton Ousler wrote that article for Liberty Magazine, and all hell broke loose. We had 800 people reply. People were going nuts. And now AA is kind of in full swing, all of this in 1 year. Now, fast forward to 1941. All the Big Books are now gone. 41, Liberty, the Saturday Evening Post, Alexander's article comes out. Now we got 8,000 requests for information. Bill and Lois and all those guys and gals up there that were helping him in that office were going nuts trying to get all this stuff replied to. Now, here's where the trouble starts. We're talking 1941. So between 1941 and 1945, Bill Wilson is taking in all this information from all these groups. This is not a case where shit's rolling downhill. It's rolling uphill. Everybody that's forming a group is calling Bill and saying, hey, Bill, we got a problem here. We got these guys 13-stepping these women. We got these guys doing this. We got these guys over here that have these weird, bizarre ways that you know that in the early days, if you were a convict, you couldn't be in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, we'd all be in trouble, most of us. If you were a woman, you couldn't. There were all kinds of things that were going on this deal. I'm telling you this because this is my plug for Bill Wilson. Bill Wilson takes it on the chin in Alcoholics Anonymous. Everybody's always wanting to step up to the plate and take Bill's inventory about his depression and about all of his other stuff, his philandering and this kind of stuff. Bill Wilson is my hero because he stayed the course. He stayed the course and sold AA on the prospect of 12 traditions which would save our fellowship. So between 1945 and 1950, when they were adopted, Bill Wilson did nothing but write those darn 12 traditions that were going to hold our deal together. I was going to be a good boy and I wasn't going to say one word about that stuff. Sorry, forgive me. Chris can be the evil twin tonight. But you understand what I'm saying here like this? I mean, Bill Wilson, everybody kept saying, don't talk about the traditions. We don't want to hear about them. But Bill could see the very basis of our fellowship dissolving out from underneath us, just as it had with the Washingtonians, just as it had with the Oxford movement. It was all disintegrating, and he could see it. And so he stayed the course, and he held us together. Tradition one, talking about unity being all important. And over the weekend, we're going to throw some tradition stuff in here because it's so hugely important. Because when I see groups dissolving now, it's real easy to go back, take out a copy of the traditions, and say, see, right here, brother, right here. This is what you're not doing, you see. I've gotten to be a huge torch carrier for the traditions these days because it's going to be what's necessary to save this deal. Turn over to XX, page 20 in the Roman numerals. The top paragraph in that thing, when I got to AA in 88, I floundered for 7 years. I got plugged in with these Big Book Thumpers, and the very first thing they did in the very first meeting I was at in that big old den of Big Book Thumpers was take me to this page, and we read this, because my arrogance says AA is fine, leave it alone. We don't need to change a bunch of stuff. Well, all these guys were trying to do was get us back on track. They weren't trying to change anything. And so what they did was, they made me read this. Of alcoholics who came to AA and really tried, 50% got sober. We've all read this stuff. At once it remained that way. 25% sobered up after some relapses. Among the remainder, those who stayed on with AA showed improvement. Other thousands came to a few AA meetings and at first decided that they didn't want the program. But great numbers of these, about 2 out of 3, began to return as time passed. If you do the math on it, it's over 90%. Over 90% of the men and women who came to this precious fellowship stayed. They got sober. They recovered. You see this stuff right here that I wrote on the board? There it is. Up through 1955, 85 to 90% of the people that came to this fellowship stayed. By 65, we're down to 50%. By 80, we're down to 33%. 94 was the last figures that I could get out of New York on the thing. We were 5% plus or minus, some areas 10%, some areas a little bit more, some areas a lot less. But you get my drift, don't you? Okay. I promise I will not get emotional about this. Scout's honor. But I dare you, I dare anybody in this room to stand there and tell me that AA is okay and look at those figures. Go ahead. It's pathetic. And millions of drunks are dying today that needlessly are out there. They don't need to be dying if we were doing what we were supposed to be doing. The reason that we've had a declining membership in AA for 3 years running is because people know the jig's up, guys. The word's out. You can't get sober in AA. So why waste the time? Oh, yes, you can. Oh, statistically, you can't. I know, you're sitting right there going, well, I'm sober and I've got friends that are sober. Guys, there should be jillions of us here. There should be bunches of us here. This is where we have to start asking the questions. And so that's what they made me do. Sitting there in that night, with me full of my own arrogance and my own ego, I was so full of piss and vinegar. The fact that I'm suicidal and I'm going nuts doesn't mean anything, you see. I'm forgetting that. But in my arrogance, I'm going, guys, it's going to be okay, man. You know? And I've come over the last 8 years to realize that everything is not okay and that we need to continually be asking ourselves those questions. Clancy, years ago, I remember hearing a tape that where he talked about pockets of enthusiasm, and it's the truth, guys. And the more I travel and the more I get a chance to talk, the more I see that exact thing. You'll go into areas where the big book has been so mutated and so watered down that it barely resembles the program that we love. And then you'll come into areas like this where you've got a bunch of big book guys, a bunch of guys excited about recovery, and it's just the coolest. It's just the coolest, man. And it should be like this everywhere. The only way to change AA is from within. The only way to do that is for me to be a strong sponsor, and I sponsor this man, and he becomes a strong sponsor. And then he sponsors him, and we just go on down the line. And you're doing the same thing, and we take our fellowship back, and we begin doing it the way we're supposed to be doing it. And we will do that. We'll see that tide turn. It's already better in some places than I've ever seen it. Anyway, enough of that stuff. Don't take our fellowship for granted, guys. Just for the sake of, for I don't know what it is here, but in Dallas 2 years ago, I took a meeting schedule and wrote that stuff up. If you needed a meeting in Dallas, there's 90 groups in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. There's 1,600 discussion meetings, 150 speaker meetings, 15 12 and 12, and 25 big books. If the forward of the first edition said that this was our basic text, this was the directions for working the work, why do we have so many discussion meetings? Yes, I'll go on record for the world. I hate discussion meetings with a passion that you will never, ever know. I do. And I know some of you love them dearly, and that's okay. And listen, I remember when I first sobered up, being in a nice discussion meeting was a fun place to be. It was. The problem with discussion meetings is that there's not enough strong chairman to chair them. So it starts out good, and this man's talking about God and the steps, and then she wants to talk about she's moving and wants to talk about the movers. And then we get to spend the rest of our valuable recovery time listening to her bad day, you see? And instead of a strong chairman going, forget it, no way, we're not going to see this meeting go down the toilet, you see? That's what we need. If we're going to keep the discussion meetings, let's make sure we got strong chair people there to make sure that the meetings stay where they're supposed to be. Turn over I want to skip the forward to the third edition. It's just a little piece of history on the deal. Bill will kill me later for skipping it, but... Nah. If there was a place that had patron saints of Alcoholics Anonymous, Dr. Silkworth has to be there. Sister Ignatia's there. Fosdick's there. Father Ed Dowling is there. I mean, these guys, none of them alcoholics, and yet they affected our stuff so dramatically, it's an amazing deal. Silkworth, picture this scenario. Silkworth, in the middle of the Depression, walks out on a limb, takes his entire career, and puts it on the line for Alcoholics Anonymous. He stands there. He was the first medical doctor to walk out on the line and say, there may be something to this physical allergy part. And believe me, people stood up and listened. People began to pay attention. Rockefeller started paying attention. The rest of the world started paying attention. It led credibility to why we do the goofy things that we do. You see? It's so cool. For a long time, I didn't understand the nature of this stuff. It's amazing how many of us can go way down range in AA. We can be way down there and still not understand why we do the crazy things we do. You know? It's an amazing thing. Why is it? Despite all that's happened to me, despite how badly I want to quit, despite 5 or 6 meetings a week, I still don't understand why it is that this obsession to drink and drug will come back, or drink will come back, and I'll be in trouble again. You see? Nobody ever explained to me these diseases, the disease of the body, mind, and spirit. Nobody ever told me about this stuff. Well, it's in the doctor's opinion. He talks heavily about the allergy, the physical part of this stuff, and he talks heavily about the mental obsession that Chris is going to pick up on in just a minute and go through the rest of this stuff. Later on in the book, they hit the spiritual malady part that drives the whole thing. But once you understand that, it helps you to understand why we're doing this stuff. The reality is, guys, that most of us get way down range in this program still thinking, really, deep down inside, still thinking that we're just badly behaved individuals. That it's a behavior deal. And I've talked to so many guys that have been sober for a bunch of time that still don't understand this thing. And it's painful, painful to see. Silkworth writes these letters, and then flip over to page 26. We can cover this pretty quick because I want to give Chris a chance to do his deal. Chris, you going to do yours after we break? Okay. In the next 25 minutes, then, we'll cover this pretty thoroughly about what we need to do. And then at the end of this stuff, what I want to do is stop 5 or so minutes into it. And if you've got a question, we'd love to hear that question, and we'll see if we can't scare up an answer for that. At the top of that page, it says, "We believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy." Here's where they introduce that. "That the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all, and once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve." Does this sound like you? I know that it does. Here's me. "Frothy emotional appeals seldom suffices. The message which can interest and hold these alcoholic people must have depth and weight. In nearly all cases, their ideals must be grounded in a power greater than themselves if they are to recreate their lives." Silkworth is making sure that we understand that your recovery is going to be based on a spiritual connection. And he frogs off into it kind of lightly, and then he hits it with both barrels, and they just keep hitting it all through the book. And so when I sit in meetings and I hear people talking about, well, you know, this, that, and the other, and they try to bring in the behavior modification, and they try to bring in all this other kind of stuff, wait a minute. From page 1 to 164, they tell us that our recovery is based on one thing, a spiritual change significant enough to bring about this recovery from alcoholism that is going to be supported and carried along by our ability to work with other alcoholics. That's it. See, God's in the center of the deal, and that's what Silkworth is trying to hit us with on this stuff. It had nothing to do with anything else. That's the message of depth and weight that we need to be carrying. Not go to 90 meetings in 90 days. That is not the message with depth and weight. We got to stop doing this, guys. The message. While we're at it, let's just nip something in the bud real quick, okay? Is it hot in here or is it just me? The next time you have a guy that you're working with, a nice protege that you just picked up, sit him down and hand him a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and ask him to go through there and show you how many times it says in the big book that our recovery depends on going to a meeting. And yet, collectively as a fellowship, isn't that a direction that we give every new guy? Keep coming back, it works. We'll see you in the meeting next week. Not my guys, you don't. I'll see you at Homeward Bound tomorrow night, you nice guy. I was going to say you dick, but I wasn't going to say that anymore. But you understand what I'm saying? Nowhere in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, our basic text, does it say that our spiritual solution lies in a meeting. It does not say it. It says we need to get up next to a drunk. That's why the group that I go to, we have three meetings a week. They're all big book studies. And every other night of the week, we're out carrying a message of recovery to some wind up joint. At the present, we're carrying 23 meetings a week other than our meetings to wind up joints. You come to our group, you're going to do 12-step work. If you're not, see ya. Wouldn't want to be ya. You're just taking up space, man. This ain't sideshow stuff here, man. This is reality. We want you on the firing line carrying a message of recovery, because it's only there that the hope of recovery lies. And it's only there that you arrive at a place where you can live comfortably in your own skin, where you can smile at your family and they can smile back, where you can sit there in the morning and breathe deeply and know that God is good and that life is good and that we have a purpose, you see? Anyway, you catch my drift. Skip down at the bottom of that page on page 26. Men and women drink essentially. If you can't relate to this, you're not an alcoholic. I'll just take your inventory right there. Judging you is what I do best, honest. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once from taking a few drinks. Still got y'all? You with me? Okay. Drinks which they see others taking with impunity, after they have succumbed to the desire again, and as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. Sounds like everybody in here. This is repeated over and over, and here it is, guys. You need look no further. And unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of his recovery. We clear there? It did not say unless we can get hooked up to the right AA group, or unless we can get the right sponsor, or unless we can blah, 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 blah. Just fill in the blank. It didn't say that. It said our solution is an entire psychic change. And so our question, here it is again, that we have to ask ourselves is, have I had a psychic change? And I don't give a rat's patootie if you're 3 weeks sober tonight or if you're 30 years sober tonight. The question needs to be asked of every one of us. Have I had the psychic change? If I have not had the psychic change, I have no business doing this. I have no message to carry. I know that irritates the crap out of some of you guys. But ask the question. And if the question is, no, I have not had the psychic change, then the next thing to do is grab somebody who has and ask him to help you through the work. And the older you are, the harder it is to do that. You give me a guy that's 15 or 20 years sober that has not experienced that burning psychic change that awakened their life, and I'll show you a man that's so consumed by his own arrogance and his own ego that he's going to kill himself, and he'll kill a bunch of you before he does. And God love him, because I know what it's like to be sober or be in the fellowship for some period of time and not understand what it was all about. I remember sitting in a meeting when I got to Primary Purpose Group, this big old den of big book thumpers. And I remember there's like 30 guys sitting around the table in those days. Our meetings tonight, they're on Tuesday night, there'll be 150 people in that meeting. And I remember sitting there in that meeting and looking around the room, and I'm going, and I've got 7 years sober at the time, and I'm looking... And I'm looking at this guy's face, and I'm looking at her eyes, I'm looking at her eyes, and I just go around the room, and I'm going, they didn't have to say a word. I knew I was different. I knew I was different. I wasn't sure at that moment exactly what it was, but I knew that the members of that group had something that I did not have. And as they talked and as we studied, I began to learn things about this big book, and God love Chris, we've talked about this before. It was so funny. We had a Tuesday night meeting, and Wednesday morning I'd be on the phone going, Chris, do you know how long Bill Wilson was sober before he started blah, blah, blah? And we'd go like this, and he wouldn't make fun of me. He wouldn't say, you stupid jerk. I will forever love my twin brother because of the way he treated me as I went through this process. Not only did he carry me to AA the first time, but he didn't laugh at me and embarrass me as we got into the deal. And as I began to learn this stuff, we have another meeting on Thursday, and Friday morning I'd call Chris. I'd say, Chris, man, you won't believe what. Listen to this. And I'd read him something out of the big book, and he'd go, yeah, that's cool stuff, man. You see? But day by day, week by week, I began to change. And I began to understand. And I began to understand that I didn't have to fear the very fellowship that was embracing me. I didn't have to be afraid that somebody was going to ask me to sponsor them. I didn't have to be afraid to carry a message of recovery. Because guess what, guys? I began slowly but surely to put together a message of depth and weight right out of the book. And I didn't have to remember any psycho crap, because remember, I'm an idiot. I didn't have to remember any esoteric stuff. I didn't have to remember any cool shit, because it was there in the book. And all I had to do was get off my lazy, skinny rear and read it. And then go carry what I read to him and to her. And I would sit there. And it's like, I could talk for years to these guys I tried to sponsor when I first got here. I'd talk to them about all this psycho stuff and the feelings and all the other crap. And they'd just kind of glaze over and check out. You know? But I'll never forget beginning to have the psychic change and working with the first guy that I sponsored, and I'm carrying a message with depth and weight, and I see his face go, huh? I never heard that before. And we talk, and I see him smile, and I see him put his life together, and I see him go home and not swat at his wife. I see him go home and be nice to his kids. You understand what I'm saying? It wasn't Myers' message anymore. It was God's message through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that was guaranteed to have the depth and weight that was necessary. And as one guy sponsored got sober, and another guy got sober, and another guy got sober, and another guy got sober, and I got the whole little army of big book thumpers out there that are sober. Was it Myers' doing? Not on your life. Not on your life. And we're going to talk about that some this weekend, how cool that stuff is. Oh, this is great. The next paragraph, at the bottom of the next paragraph, the only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules. They were going to make us take the steps, God forbid. You know, Chris, I want to save you some time to do some of this stuff. I want to... Two fast things we want to cover in the next couple of minutes. Everybody in here, there's not anybody in here that doesn't understand the allergy. Is that correct? You understand when you drink, you get drunk, and that's it. I mean, but once the allergy sets itself up and we start drinking and we continue to drink, and you understand that. That to a large extent is the most that any of us get out of our knowledge of alcoholism for many, many years. I drink and I can't stop. I drink and I get drunk. But we don't understand this stuff. The most baffling feature of this whole thing, of that three-part disease of body, mind, and spirit, the mental part, the mental obsession, the stuff that Chris is going to elaborate on in just a minute, is the biggest single baffler of why we do those things. It's the part that baffles our families mightily. But it's the part that very few people understand. We have the only disease known to man that has a component to it that tells us that the problem does not exist. And there is the weirdest deal, you see? No matter how bad things get, you know, you guys, you go to a bar, you get the crap beat out of you. That morning you say, I'll never do it again, as you look through these eyes all welded shut. And then, where are you 24 hours later? Drunk. Again. Now, where is the logic in that? My sainted wife, over there with the coffee cup, right there. When we were dating 20 some odd years ago, 25 years ago, 4 years ago, we went out and we had some brewskis, and she was eating a hamburger, and she dropped this hamburger in her lap. And it embarrassed her just something fierce. And over the years, you know, if she drinks something, she thinks about that night, and she says, you know, I don't want to do this anymore. I'm not going to get drunk like that. She wasn't even really drunk, but you know the drill. But isn't it funny, because of the mental obsession, no matter how bad it gets, you know, you got your hands handcuffed and you're laying over the hood of a police car, 24 hours later, 48 hours tops, I guarantee you, you won't remember any of it. None of it. All you'll remember is the restless, irritable, and discontent part and how good a beer would be. And there it is again. Isn't it peculiar? Maybe I'm the only guy in here that does this. No matter how bad things got, I can be 2 days away from a drink, and I'm sitting there, and I'm restless and irritable. I'm so uncomfortable in my own skin, I'm ready to scream. And my head takes me to a night on the Guadalupe River in Kerrville, Texas, and the moon's coming up through the cypress trees, and the wind's blowing across there, and I've got this little pimply-faced girl right here in this arm, and I got me a quart of Budweiser in this hand, and life is good. Believe me, life is good. And that's where my head takes me. All those years ago. Guys, there's a perfect example of a mental obsession. You see? And there's why we end up so baffled by our deal. And that's why our families want to strangle us, because they can't understand. If you loved her enough, you'd stop that crap. Joe, you want this job? You're going to have to stop. Does Joe want his job? Sure. Did he want the girl? Sure. Did he want it sufficiently enough to steer clear of the booze? On one level, yes. But could we do it? No. No. There it is. There it is. That's all I want to do right now. We'll take a fast smoke break, and then we'll come back and do the rest of that. Thanks, guys. I need to clarify one thing. I've already been jammed up a couple of times by this, and what I want to make sure that you understand is that don't go back and tell your sponsor that I said you ain't going to meetings anymore. I understand the value of a meeting. I do. I'm not saying that. What I'm trying to get us to see is that when we put all of the emphasis on the meeting itself, we sell the program short, and we find that guys get sicker instead of better. That's all I was saying. Sometimes it takes time to get into the deal. There are circumstances beyond our control, education circumstances and whatnot, that sometimes the best we can do is just hang on and go to a meeting until we get well enough to start doing the work. I understand that. But we cannot hide behind the meeting and get hung up in the fellowship end of the deal to the extent that we never get on the firing line and do the necessary work. Remember now, as drunks, we'll usually take the easier, softer way when it presents itself. Isn't that right? We will. And so this is just another one of those situations. We need to get with that work just as fast as we can. Before we left, I was supposed to do a fast Q&A and see if there was anybody that had any questions based on what we were talking about before Chris starts. Did anybody have a question on any of that stuff that we talked about the first part? Yes, sir. There's a mic right there, and for the tape purposes, if you want to come up and just ask your question right there, that'd be great. If it's a hard question, these guys will answer it. That sounds...
Hi, I'm Richard. I'm a grateful alcoholic.
That sounds better. Thanks, Richard.
Do you believe that this fellowship is largely consist nowadays, and you know, going into why the recovery rates are so low, do you believe that it fundamentally has to do with the fact that there aren't, it's the fellowship primarily is not made up of real alcoholics, but very likely, problem drinkers and the like, and that's, you know, they come in, they could hug the coffee pot, so on and so forth, and, you know, do damage to those who really need to get the message.
I didn't pay him to say that, but I would have paid him to ask that question. These guys may have another comment on that, but let me I think one of the greatest areas that we have strayed off into the ozone here is that we stopped qualifying the drunk. You want to talk about that, son? Go ahead. Oh, you want to do it when you're doing it? Okay. We stop qualifying the drunk, and there's where we get into trouble. We got guys that come, and we don't find out. Early AA, they ask such pointed questions. They didn't care about your feelings so much. They wanted to know if you belonged here. And if you belonged here, we're going to get on down the road and do what's necessary. But I think that's the big problem. A lot of people just hide out in a fellowship now. That's it. Anybody else have one? We good? All righty, here's Chris. Oh, go ahead. You can...
I'm Steve, alcoholic. I'm newly sober, and I've been hearing a lot that I should wait 90 days to start doing any work.
Are some of you feeling nauseous like me? Listen. All I want to do is ask you one thing. We have a fellowship that God gave us that's guaranteed to give us a new chance at life. to completely change who we are and what we are, and we want you to wait 90 days to get it? I've never understood that logic, ever.
An alcoholic. I was very curious about the numbers you used. You got those from New York, and what was it a rate of?
The numbers. Thanks for asking. The numbers originally were a guy named Floyd H. in Houston originally got the numbers, and he put them together through mostly chip sales and stuff. But the information came from New York, most of that. And that's the reason why we stopped at 94 because that's the last time that we could actually verify those figures.
And it was people who stayed. Is that what it was?
Stay a year.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You bet.
My name is Peter. I'm an alcoholic. I just want to back up to that gentleman who just asked the question about the 90 days with the steps. Real simple way, where in the big book does it say that we wait 90 days to take the steps? And what you really need to sit with when you get information like that is, can you find the information you're getting in a big book, Alcoholics Anonymous? Because as my sponsor has taught me, I never let anyone read my big book for me. So now you may get someone who's a non-alcoholic giving you information that's going to kill a real alcoholic. Are you a moderate drinker, hard drinker? You could probably wait 90 days or 6 months or maybe never do the steps. And there's a lot of that in Alcoholics Anonymous. And bless them. They're coming from the best place that they only know what they know. But if you're a real alcoholic like the person on page 21, the question to sit with, besides it not being in your big book, can you wait that long before you are faced with a gun to your head and the trigger's cocked, and what are you going to do? Can you really sit and wait 90 days before you begin having a spiritual awakening, which is vital to you staying sober into your life? So anything that's not given to me, that's not my big book, I really have to sit with and question with, probably coming from a non-alcoholic.
Hi, everybody. Rich Alcoholic, Plymouth, Mass. I'd like to ask the panel, when do you feel or do you know when the separation from doing the steps as opposed to just going to a meeting and not drinking really started to happen?
I don't understand the question.
When was the separation between going to a meeting and not drinking was enough as opposed to doing the steps thoroughly? When did that separation happen?
I can answer that fairly quickly. There is nothing about the meeting inherent that solves the spiritual malady, that deals with that aspect. And so it's possible going to meetings every day for you to get sicker and sicker and sicker. And so the answer to your question seems to be, how sick do you want to get before you finally start doing the work? And can you stay sober that sick? One of the funny things to do is regardless of how long you've been going to a meeting, let's say you've been going to a meeting 6 months and you've not really delved into the deal, you're just enjoying the fellowship, but you're not working the work, go to page 52 and read the bedevilments, which we all know, or go read the promises on 83 and 84, and ask yourself, how much of that is true in my life? And if nothing is true in your life, if you're having trouble with all that stuff, then you're dying of untreated alcoholism within the fellowship, doing the stuff, see? And so it's time to get with the action stuff that they keep talking about in the book. Does that answer kind of what you were talking about?
No, thank you.
I'm sorry.
I guess
I'm sorry. Early 60s. It all went to hell in a handbasket in the early 60s. Can you hear me? Is this on? Yeah. It all went to hell in a handbasket about the time that people realized they could make money off drunks' butts.
Yeah.
Treatment centers. Yeah.
Next question. How you doing, everybody? I'm an alcoholic. My name is Matt Stovey.
Hey, Matt.
You mentioned that your home group does 12-step work, 12-step calls, and you go seek drunks out at detoxes or whatever. My question is, when you do that, are you guys, you go right into the book? Are you sharing your experience? Are you bringing them through the work? How are you doing that? Like, what's your format? Or you guys have meetings that you go to? I guess it's a couple-part question, but...
What was your first name?
Matt.
Matt, if there's any chance you can hang around till Sunday morning, because we're going to spend most of Sunday morning talking about that specifically, rather than getting into it tonight.
Okay, thanks.
Or you can see me afterwards. If you're going to leave tonight, just see me afterwards, and I'll be glad to tell you all about it.
Okay, great. Thanks.